It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 548 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is a special double feature episode, and it stars Paul Cornell and Steve Yoel from Three Little Wishes and Caleb Palmquist from Unicorn Vampire Hunter. Paul and Steve are up first, and of course they're accomplished creators who have just released Three Little Wishes, a graphic novel from Legendary Comics. It's 128 pages long, and it tells the story of Kelly Castleton, a detail-oriented and by-the-book contract lawyer who stumbles upon an ancient magic with the power to change everything. When Fairy King Oberon is released from his enchanted imprisonment, he offers her three little wishes. What could possibly go wrong? We explore how the book came to be, who the characters are, and what else these talented creators are up to. Then everything wraps up with the return of Caleb Palmquist, who's running an already successful Kickstarter campaign for Unicorn Vampire Hunter numbers 1 through 5. We talk about the series, what the future holds for it and its characters, and what other projects Caleb is working on. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what everyone has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast the creators of Three Little Wishes from Legendary Comics. And that starts out with creator and writer Paul Cornell. How are you, Paul?
Oh, fine. Good evening. Thank you for having me on.
It's good to talk with you. And the artist, Steve Yowell. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm good. Thanks very much, Wayne. How are you?
Good, good. Now, let's start off, I guess, with Paul, since you're the creator there. Let's talk about how this came to be. Well, do you want me to read the summary, or would you like to?
It's a book about a finicky contract lawyer who has a problem with being too finicky. She has perhaps too much finick, who finds a bottle in which is the King of the Fairies. King of the Fairies gets freed, grants her three wishes, but he is the sort of cruel wish-granting fairy that wants to trip humans up and have them hoist by their own wishes and have them fall foul of awful wordings in the wishes. But she's very finicky, and she writes wishes that he cannot see any way around. So she wants to save the world. But then along comes her ex, who she still loves, and the rom-com bit gets in the way of the saving the world bit, and things become very complicated. The idea came from when I was sitting in with my agent, and my agent is married to a contract lawyer. And I just thought, I had in my head the idea of doing a book about wishes and changing the world, because I think, you know, we all have fantasies about changing the world right now. And how exactly the person a fairy would not want to encounter when granting wishes is a contract lawyer. And that hence it all came from that.
Wow, okay, that's funny. Now, the contract lawyer's name is Kelly Castleton. And the Fairy King's name is Oberon, interestingly mm-hmm. enough. I think that's really good stuff. So I find it so interesting because you're right. This is the exact wrong person that a wish-granting fairy wants to get into, because as an attorney, you know, most people, and you've read all the genie jokes where people talk about, you know, genies granting requests. You never get exactly what you think you're getting when you ask that. So it's kind of funny. But what happens is, right off the bat, she does something that really that he wasn't expecting, and neither was I. She says she's going to get back to him.
Yep, because she can't do this off the top of her. You know, it's a big responsibility. It takes some thought.
Because, you know, normally when if I was granted that stuff, I would immediately say, well, I want this and I want that and I want this. And she doesn't do that.
Would you perhaps, as one of the fairies' victims in the past said, ask to be rich for the rest of one's life? Yeah, I like that.
See, well, it's really a fascinating story because it does make you think about what would you do in this situation? And lots of fun.
Yeah. And Steve is just the person to draw this because me and him had worked on a title called Edgar Allan Poe's Snifter of Terror for Ahoy, where we did a short story. And, you know, I was a great fan of Steve from back in the day, but I hadn't before quite grasped his mastery of wry comedy, that he could do character comedy with lots of really precise expressions. And I thought, oh, if I have a big comedy, I want to have him as the artist. And then along came a big comedy.
Great, great. Well, Steve, what was your reaction when you heard about it first?
Well, I thought it was. I got a sense, as Paul explained, we'd worked together on a short story for Edgar Allan Poe's Snifter of Doom. And I think we met at a Thought Bubble shortly afterwards, didn't we, Paul?
Yeah.
And he kind of said there, do you want to do something else? And naturally I said, of course I do. And then it was probably the month after that he emailed me to say he'd pitched this idea to Legendary. Was I interested in drawing it? Which naturally I said yes, because I'd enjoyed the Edgar Allan Poe story so much. And then I got the synopsis from Nikita, and I thought, you know, this sounds great, and I could see quite early on that the nature of the story was going to require me to do an awful lot of character acting that I don't normally get the opportunity to draw in the comics I usually do. So I clutched it eagerly with both hands.
That's funny. So it is interesting because most comics are action oriented as opposed to dramatic oriented. So it sounds like this was kind of a fun challenge for you to take on.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It's. I mean, I've always been fascinated by those 1950s love comics, which romance comics, I say, not love comics, maybe, that rely much more on character acting and the narrative, the relationships between the characters. So yeah, it was. I saw it as a great opportunity and a really interesting challenge.
Really good. And the thing I'm interested too, and then we get back to Paul on the story, was the way that their appearance was kind of interesting. The Oberon, the King of the Fairies, he doesn't look like what I would expect the King of the Fairies to look like.
Well, Paul kind of gave some pointers as to Oberon's general appearance. He was kind of supposed to be sort of that kind of bluff, not so much a buffoon, but a kind of Falstaffian figure, I think. Would that be right, Paul?
Yeah, very much, yeah.
Very good, very good. He's a comical character, and he is exactly what I kind of expected from a genie or something. But although he makes a differentiation between a genie and a fairy, which I thought was kind of interesting. But
the genies have got all the PR. They've got the PR side. They've got the PR side sewn up, he says, because he's actually a very English fairy.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. Is Kelly also English or?
No. It's an American setting, American characters. But I just thought that if you've got the King of the Fairies from Shakespeare, basically, he's got to be English.
Now, I've got to ask, of course, Steve, are these characters, is their appearance based on real people? Are they based on your what you and Paul worked out? How did you come up with what Oberon looked like and then Kelly?
Well, they may or may not be based on real people. Paul kind of, as I explained, gave some pointers as to which direction he wanted to go. And I performed some Google foo and kind of got some cast members I thought I might like to base their likenesses on. But beyond that, I guess it's a mix of existing people and our imaginations.
Mm, very good, very good. Now, see, I get a kick out of Oberon because most fairies, when I see them in comics or in any other kind of illustrations, they're slender and they're tall, or they're like the Disney fairies that are very small. And he's not.
No, he's a bear. He gets called a bear during the course of this comic, and he says, "Well, I have been a bear," and he's very much a more stout chap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's part of the thing that this book does is it challenges our perceptions of things, because when I came to look at him, the moment he first appears, he appears behind Kelly when the first time, and let's just say that clothes were not something he was used to doing at that point.
Well, no, I mean, he has to learn all of human civilization and culture in a matter of milliseconds there, so he's doing quite well just to be able to get the language. But he learns clothes a couple of seconds later.
Plus he went to Woodstock.
It's just quite a bit of fun. Now, we should talk a little bit about how they got, how she came across him, which was just kind of fun for me. That sets up the whole story. She is a very, as she's described as detail-oriented and by the book. So she actually does something that is spontaneous.
Yeah, her friend encourages her friend Annie, who's a major part of this book, encourages her to do something radical and dangerous and off the cuff just for once in her life. So she goes on an auction site and buys the contents of a sealed lot, a sealed abandoned packing area, a storage lot, for a lower price than anybody's ever seen this sold before, for $10, basically. And she regards this as being tremendously reckless. In this respect, she's rather like my dad, who, in his older age, used to try to bet on horses for tiny sums of money. Because he regarded gambling as inherently risky, but he quite enjoyed it, but he would only gamble, in the end, sums so small that the betting shops refused to deal with him. And Kelly reminds me of him in a lot of ways, and of me. I mean, I'm incredibly detail-oriented. I'm incredibly neat. I discovered in my mother's dotage, when she was suffering from degenerative neural disease, etc., and she didn't really know what she was saying, she suddenly said about me, "Oh, that'll be your autism." And I went, "What?" And yeah, apparently I was diagnosed when I was a kid. My parents, this being a different age, never told me, never told anybody else. And so, yeah, I'm kind of an inverse Spock. I've got my son is autistic, and thank goodness can live openly as that. But so this, I realized that this story of somebody who's wrestling with being too detail-oriented and too precise is kind of my own story and comes from quite a deep place. And so yeah, it's got a slightly deeper note than you might imagine to it. But you should see. I was going to say you should see our bedroom, me and my wife. But you know, hey, I don't want to make that invitation. But because my wife is really quite messy, and so it's kind of like there's a dotted line down the middle of the room. There's one really really neat side and one really quite messy side. And yeah, that's me. I am Kelly.
Oh wow! Okay, it's funny how opposites attract.
Well, you say that. I really, I keep saying, could that convention badge has been sitting there for 4 years now.
Okay, that's funny because she, like I said, she, the first thing that she does is she decides she has to think about it. And so she says she's going to get back to him, which leaves him with time on his hands, which is something, he's been bottled up for so long. Now, suddenly he doesn't know what to do. He's got time to do. So he goes out and does some looking around and actually gets involved in human society a little bit, which is kind of fun for him. And meanwhile, she's gone back to talk to her friend and figure out what she wants to do as far as all this goes, which was fun for me because I guess I'm more the opposite as well. I don't look at that. I don't just sit and think about that. I would be very spontaneous and say, okay, I want this and I want that. And of course, that's what the fairy's hoping for.
Yep.
So he is very surprised when she goes a different route.
And she drafts an immense number of drafts to the wish and includes lots of sub-clauses. Because honestly, this is what it'll take to save the world. I think that we could do with a few more people who are into the business of very fine detail and aren't just, oh, we'll do the broad strokes and it'll all sort itself out. It's really not sorting itself out.
Well, of course, the story of genies and then jokes with genies and stuff always talk about the fact that, you know, you wish for something, but the way that you word it has something to do with what you get. And so I got a huge kick out of this. Is why she doesn't she give him like a whole stack of papers mm-hmm. to go through, and he has to go through and look at the whole thing. And then when he gets to the end, he kind of realizes, okay.
And he tries to summarize. He goes, so basically world peace, right? And no, every single one of those subclauses.
Oh, that was funny. It's funny to see. So, Steve, as far as like illustrating these kinds of things, what was it like to illustrate the fact that she's not going to jump to the decisions, and she's going to do, you have to illustrate her that she's the more pensive and thoughtful way to approach that. That's not what we see in comics very often.
I guess not. I was going back and looking at a lot of Kurt Schaffenberger, Lewis Lane stories, to get a feel as to how to approach the whole thing as well. Lane with a kind of, you know, with an arched brow or lowered, sort of half lowered eyelids, just to suggest a mood or a reaction was kind of, it was enormously skilled, far more skilled than I am. But it was a good reference point to go back and study for the purposes of drawing Three Little Wishes. Yeah, it was quite a challenge, but a really good one.
Because comic books tend to be action oriented, superheroes punching, kicking. Yelling and stuff like that, the old sitting on the toilet look, the kind of things that we get on their faces very often. So it was nice to see a more humane and more human look to the characters and stuff like that too. So I really enjoyed, that was part of the thing that I really enjoyed. And of course, this book is 128 pages long. And so you've got a good story to get into. And I love good long stories. I like to get into something that I can just drop into and be lost in for a little while. And that's the way this book was. It was very engaging.
Well, it's part of the attraction for me that it was a proper graphic novel. We got to tell one big long story. And of course, Steve's way with expression goes way back to Zenith, where Grant Morrison told a very British, very restrained superhero story where there's a lot going on in terms of expression and nuance. And, I really should have thought about Steve's ability to do this from way back in the day. I can see the Lois Lane stuff. I know exactly what you mean. That's fascinating.
Kurt Schaffenberger, fun enough, was one of my favourite Superman artists. I mean, obviously, having drawn Superman within the pages of Lois Lane.
Mm, wow. Absolutely.
Did I hear right that in America, in the States, we call it Zenith? Did you do – Zenith is the name of it?
Yeah, it's English vowels. There's a difference between U.S. and English vowels, Wayne. Don't worry.
I read that book, and I loved that book. I have to tell you, that was one of the first Grant Morrison books I ever read. And they put it out recently in like collected editions and stuff. And I I scrambled to get it. I wanted that book because I loved that story so much. It was, again, so not what I expected. So I really loved that. Man, I just want to tell you, I loved that book. I thought that was a fantastic book. We would say Zenith here in the States, but Zenith, really great.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it was great. It was a great project to work on at the time as well.
Wow, so that's really something special. I didn't realize you were in that. So that's, I'm glad to I get to express to you how much I enjoyed that. It was great. Of course, I like Paul's stuff too. Over the years, it's really been tremendous stuff as well.
Well,
I'm kind of curious though, Paul. You know, because you guys have lots of experience in comics, and you were saying about how doing a graphic novel for a change. Did you find it, Paul, a challenge to write something that was longer, you know, a longer story as opposed to, you know, the 22-page comics format these days?
Well, you know, most of the time with 22-page comics, you're writing with a plotting eye towards the arc, towards the 5 issues, 6 issues. So, honestly, this is just 6 issues, but back-to-back, and I don't have to think about artificial climaxes every 20 pages. And that's actually the joy of it, that I can do an arc shape that lasts a proper 120 pages and isn't 6 bursts, but, you know, has arcs landing wherever they want to land. And, you know, I think actually this is the way of the future. So much is going towards the original graphic novel now. And, you know, for one thing, I wanted to be part of the idea that comics is a medium, not a genre, and to do a proper fantasy rom-com in comics and to do a proper fantasy rom-com in a graphic novel. You know, this will sit in bookstores. This will be, you know, something that is hopefully will cross over to a bookstore audience. And that I find immensely attractive. I've really wanted the British and American market to move to something more like the French market, where a French comic book store looks very like a bookstore. And we're talking about individual volumes. And, you know, the latest volume of Blake and Mortimer will be advertised on the subway as, you know, here's the latest Bondazine that is, you know, a proper graphic novel in what in Britain and the States we'd regard as a Tintin or Asterix size collection. And I hope we're moving towards that, and I hope Three Little Wishes is part of that.
That's interesting because it's a conflict that I have these days because I want to get the individual issues when they come out. And if it's a really good thing, I'll buy the graphic novel collection.
Well, I'm a collector, so I understand the urge towards individual issues. But at the same time, I do think they get in the way a bit.
Interesting. Because, you know, I talked a long time ago with Bob Layton, and he was saying something that interested me, that he kind of feels like you do, that the move of comics is going to be towards more collected editions, graphic novels. In fact, like if you go to European bookstores and comic shops, they'll rarely have individual issues. They will have mostly collected or graphic novels.
Well, I'm signing on Saturday at a shop which is a comic shop, but which has no individual issues.
Wow.
And you know, it's got lots and lots of both collected editions and graphic novels.
But once upon a time, the European market was, I mean, the graphic novels, European graphic novels as we think of them now, were originally compilations of serialized stories, weren't they? Because Tintin and Asterix, maybe Cortom or Maltese, would appear in the monthly magazines like Pelot and Esuive. And then, though, as like six-page installments, possibly even in black and white, from what I understand.
And these are anthologies, so yeah, you get a little bit of everything.
They would collect the episodes, colour them, and then put them in the hardback graphic novel. But eventually, the monthly publications died out because people didn't want to pay twice for everything.
Yeah.
That's funny, because I have double dipped many times. I'll buy the individual issues when they come out. Sometimes I even buy the digital version if it comes out. Sometimes it'll come out ahead of what the print version. I will buy the digital version so I can read it on the computer, and then I'll buy the individual issues. And they're bagged and boarded at the store I go to. She does it automatically. And so I sit there and take that, and I go, oh, I read that already. I'll put that aside and not even have to crack the spine.
Well, that's good for your collection. I waver a bit. I mean, when that new Jackson Lansing, Colin Kelly Star Trek comes out, I might go and get the first issue, and then I'll go get the trades religiously. But, you know, it's part of me does want the individual issues. But anyway, the energy behind this book has been tremendous. I mean, we really ought to talk about how great the other contributors are here. They're a married couple, Pippa and Simon Boland, who do the colour art and the lettering. And they both make substantial contributions to this. I love the way that the book has a sort of Californian sunlight throughout, which feels very appropriate to a rom-com. And the lettering... I particularly like the small lettering. I love the sound effects, like when Kelly face palms into the lunar surface. And I love my sound effects. I don't use many of them, but for this one, I just wrote spaff. And Simon does it tiny, that spaff. I've always believed that if one is good to do a sound effect, because I'm kind of sound effect blind in comics, I don't often read them, I don't register them. So I think if one is going to do a sound effect, it should be really chosen and precise. And I love it when a letterer goes with it.
Can I just back Paul up on Pippa and Simon's contribution? When Pippa's a great colorist. She works quite regularly for 2000 AD. Her and Simon, what the pair of them brought to the book is a really important element.
Well, how did they get to be part of the team? Did you pick them, or did Legendary? How did that happen?
I think I picked them, didn't I? I think
you must have done.
Yeah, they're mates, and I know their work is good, so I do tend to rely on people I know a bit. On our editor, Nikita, it was tremendous. And this book really needed an editor, because you need somebody keeping track. You know, it won 120-page narrative. I think her contribution was excellent.
She was a dream to work with. I mean, she really did kind of step from my perspective. As long as I stayed on the schedule I'd given her, she really did just step back and leave me to get on with the work. There was no sort of stream of nagging emails asking me where pages were. She kind of trusted me to get the work in, which was great.
And what I love about Steve again is the precision that when you get the roughs back. And you can say, oh, it's not quite there. Can we do try it that way? And the second time will be perfect. And just exactly, you know, he's about 80% of the time he's nailing it exactly like I saw it in my head, or doing that wonderful thing where you get a page and it's not what you saw in your head, it's better. That happens a lot. But he started to go to town on Oberon background stuff. Like, when I hadn't given Oberon anything to do, Steve will have give him something to do in the background. And, so I love that stuff. This is my favourite thing in comics, being surprised by the artist.
That was nothing to do with me, Paul. That was the character telling me what to do.
Absolutely.
See, that's funny because I often ask creators about that, especially writers. You give a script to somebody, and then when you start to see the pages, the interpretation often of the artist brings something into the story that you may not have originally conceived. And you go with that because suddenly it makes things so much better.
Yeah.
And it's great to hear that continues on, because sometimes when somebody thinks visually about it and makes that change, boy, it's something really special to see.
Well, it's not as extreme as Peter David's example that he wrote for a artist who whose English was not their first language. He bursts into the room, his chopper over his head. And the artist drew a little helicopter above the guy in question, and Peter David was so charmed by the villain with the little helicopter that he kept it in and kept it going.
I was learning Spanish at a time, and they said that you have to be careful on how the connotation and the denotation goes. If you say in English, we say in American particularly, she was so surprised she hit the ceiling.
Right.
And other people, if you say it in Spanish, they visualize somebody on the top of a ladder with a hammer hitting the ceiling.
Right, right. So this has happened to me in minor ways a couple of times, actually. But that's the bad side of the surprise, but the good side of the surprise is terrific. Leonard Kirk, I once said to him on Captain Britain, we've got a page here for a fight scene. You know what's at stake. You know the emotional issues here with the protagonists. Why don't you just go to town? And he drew a page with 16 panels on it. I would never script 16 panels on a page. Can you imagine, Steve, getting that?
Yeah, it would give you a heart attack.
Well, this book really sparkles, I have to say. And one of the things I really liked about it was kind of the progression of the characters through the whole book. They start in one place, but 128 pages later, each one of them is in a very different place than when they started. And character growth is something I always love to see in a story. And so for me, it was Oberon is doing stuff I didn't expect he would do by the end. And, the way that everybody's acting and working with stuff, to me, it was very heartening to see these people develop and move in human directions as if they were real people. I thought that was one of the best parts of the book.
Well, thank you so much. I really should mention Pigeon Lee, because Kelly's first wish is basically an end to all violence, that no act of violence can be successfully accomplished. And Pigeon Lee was a great professional assassin who now feels a bit lost. He does not have much motivation in life anymore, and so he comes to Kelly and is impotently angry at her, and raises his voice quite a lot, and having tried and failed to kill her in numerous interesting ways involving trying to take his intention to do so out of the equation. So, yeah, I'm quite fond of Pigeon Lee, and Steve draws him in a wonderfully doleful way with kind of long, lank hair and a very mournful expression.
Well, yeah, and Pigeon Lee was great fun to draw. In fact, Paul, if you ever want to write a follow-up graphic novel featuring Pigeon Lee, drop me a line.
I think that – I wonder what he's doing in the world of Three Wishes after the end.
Well, that's a good question. Before we get to that, though – I also like the ex-boyfriend's storyline.
Oh, yeah, because that's our serious bit, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, it's touching. Oh my goodness.
I don't want to spoil what the thing is with him, but our heroine is very tempted to use a wish just on him, and he really doesn't want that. And you draw him very handsomely, Steve, and you give him a kind of movie starish feel,
I can vaguely remember who I based him on.
Is it Daniel Day Kim?
You'd have to tell me what Daniel Day Kim has been in.
He was in Lost way back.
Yes, it could possibly be, but perhaps for copyright reasons, I better not confirm or deny.
Well, he doesn't entirely look like him. I mean, he reminds me of a number of people.
Well, that storyline really got to me, though, I have to say. That was the one I actually was, well, I was hoping, you got me to hope that she would use one of her wishes in the way that the story kind of indicated.
Good. That's what we're after. You're rooting for her to waste a wish.
It was so interesting. You can't help but during this whole story wonder what you would do in these situations.
Yeah,
I just couldn't help but wonder about that. Now, you brought up something that I wanted to ask about. Is Three Little Wishes the end of the Three Little Wishes universe? Are there other stories you might want to do there?
I think it's done. I think it's very much. I cannot see what. I mean, you know, you don't want to keep on writing after the end of a rom-com, really. You don't get four weddings and a funeral too. This time it's more weddings. they just call it five weddings. I don't think so. I mean, nice to do some Pigeon Lee shorts, I think.
Do you know how uncommon that is in comic books? Because comics are always trying to continue the stories. I mean, you have to write Batman so that next month, somebody else can pick up Batman and keep going, but yeah, he's got to put him back where he was so somebody else can do the same thing.
Well, that's my problem, really. I wouldn't. I'd want to have major, major consequences in Batman's life that change everything, the end. You see why I don't write Batman, basically. Not anymore.
Well, it's interesting because I love character growth. I love people moving and getting somewhere, and it's very humane the way that things progress. And I actually, the girlfriend I kind of liked too, she was kind of a fun, she moved the main character in directions and was a sounding board for her. And I kind of thought that, you know, I a lot of us would like to have friends like that.
Yeah, Addie is the voice of reason. And at one point, she has an enormous internal ethical issue to deal with. And I think that's the real joy of romance comics, rom-coms included, that you get to actually wrestle with the big emotions. And this one kind of falls you into it. And I'd like to think we drag you into it. And then you find you're in the midst of actually quite a powerful ethical dilemma. And of course, this was never the case for Lois Lane. Lois Lane's dilemma was, you know, how can I basically trick Superman into marriage? But,
Yeah, and he's kind of the Jiminy Cricket to Kelly's Pinocchio.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I always loved that thing when they say he had to trick Superman into a loving and caring relationship.
Yeah. I got to say, I recently read some of the ancient Jimmy Olsons, and it's a fantastic world for children. It must be said that they are very well-written children's stories, and I absolutely see the joy of them. This very developed universe where everything functions on child logic, basically, including the play-acted versions of adult relationships, which are they're kind of pitched exactly right for a 7 or 8 year old reader, and you know, I think there's a place for that. I think they're charming.
I do too. I grew up reading those books.
Hmm.
So for me, I Superboy was one of my favorites because here's a boy with the abilities of Superman trying to figure out what's the thing he should be doing.
Absolutely.
He had to adult.
And there's there's kind of no growth, but what there is building. The universe gets more and more, gets more and more stuff in it so that they can use each bit of stuff to launch an interesting new thing. Mm-hmm. But once more, this is the thing about being on a comics podcast. We talk comics. I've been talking and talking. Steve should talk.
Well, but let me ask you guys a question, though. I mean, as far as you said, as far as the Three Little Wishes cast and the area, we probably won't see any more of that. But what about the team? Are you interested in having the team do more things together?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It just has to be the right thing, really. I mean, I kind of... I think Steve is basically capable of anything, but there are things which he's especially good at. And I would love to do another rom-com. I've actually got another rom-com pitch with Legendary, and we will reunite the team if that goes ahead.
Yeah, that'd be great. Get Pippa and Simon back. Dream team. Hmm.
Very good, very good. Well, why don't we find out what you're up to, Steve? As far as like other projects, are there things you're working on that you can talk about? And you can let us know what's coming.
Sure. Yeah, I'm doing some work for 2000 AD at the moment. Working on a couple of characters called Sinister Dexter, written by Dan Ebnett. Dan's script's always great fun. Apart from that, it's I've got a working on a few private commissions. There's a couple of projects being vaguely discussed at the moment, but nothing concrete. But work ticks over. Thank you very much.
Okay. How about you, Paul?
I've got another original graphic novel being announced in the next 2 weeks from a different company in an entirely different genre. And I've got another creator-owned series out by announced by the end of the year. And I'm back at Marvel at the moment, doing adapting George R. R. Martin and Melinda Snodgrass's Wild Cards into comics.
Cool.
So lots of comic stuff. And I've got a new SF novella, Rosebud, out from Tor.com.
Wow. Now, Steve, back to you. If people want to follow you on social media, is there a place they can do that?
Sure. Yeah, I'm on Facebook under my own name. You'll notice me because there's a little picture of Zenith, and I'm on Instagram as Stevie Owell Art.
Cool, cool. And how about you, Paul?
If you go to my blog at paulcornell.com, you'll find all of my socials.
Very good, very good. Okay, so this is a great book. I want to end it by saying a very fun, very involving read that 128 pages just flew by as far as I was concerned.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I highly recommend you can get it. It's fully available now. I think you can get it through Amazon. You can go, I think the shops, I don't know if it's hit local shops yet, but I think it will.
I think it has.
Okay, well, the thing to do is check with your local shop then and make sure to order Three Little Wishes from Legendary and Paul and Steve's work. And if you see stuff that these guys work on, I would definitely buy it because you're going to get something, a good read out of it and something you're going to treasure. So be sure to do that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Wayne.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to welcome back to the podcast Caleb Palmquist, the creator of many wonderful things, but currently a Kickstarter going for Unicorn Vampire Hunter 1-5. How's it going, Caleb?
It's going great. Thanks for having me.
It's good to talk with you. I was listening to the video on the Kickstarter, and it said that this is your favorite of your creations.
That's true. Up until now, certainly. I have fun with everything I do, but this one is really like exactly the story I want to tell.
Okay, because I think one of the other ones recently was Vampire Detective in Space, if I remember correctly.
Correct, yep.
And you did, what was the name of the one that was the compilation one? We had multiple creators involved.
Oh, that was called A Small Favor. That was my first comic.
Yeah, I got that in Tampa when you were there. Yeah, I remember that. You can see the end in sight now as far as this book. So
at least for the first arc.
So how's that feel, you know, getting to the place where we've actually got the first arc done?
It feels great. I mean, this will be really, truly the first time that I have finished a comic book arc and gotten it out in the world. And this is something that I've been thinking about and working on for a long time, so it feels great.
Wow, okay. Because, let's see, the description is kind of interesting at the top of the thing. It's an all-ages fantasy adventure about a unicorn who hunts vampires with his horn. Duh.
Yep.
Funny stuff. And that kind of reflects the humor in the series as well.
Yeah, I would say it's a funny book. It's also a dramatic book. I would say that the drama and the characters come first, but there's definitely plenty of humor in it.
Okay, because I always get a kick out of vampires because I always think it's done, and then people come up with a new take on vampires, and off you go.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty good. So how long have you been thinking about this story?
Oh, man. So I originally wrote a treatment of this story in 2011. Back before I was really thinking about doing comic books. I kind of wrote this silly story. It was a fairy tale about a unicorn who hunts vampires. And then I kind of put it on the shelf. I still have the sort of handwritten pages of the original story, I wrote it way back then, and then it went through a lot of different iterations. It was almost going to be my first comic book, and the truth is, a friend of mine and I had a discussion where we were like, that's too silly. People aren't going to want to read that. And so instead, we went with a convoluted sci-fi space opera thing that was not that popular, turns out, when I came back to this one, people really did want to read it.
Maybe the timing was right when you got to it.
Yeah.
So let me read a little more about the description. It says, Unicorn Vampire Hunter is a fantasy adventure comic about a curious young woman, a wise wizard, and a unicorn with a penchant for killing vampires. It's a heartfelt story about friendship, love, and finding purpose in an unpredictable world. And boy, do we need that now.
I think so. And there's definitely big themes about finding purpose and about found family. So if those things appeal to you, certainly I think you'll like this book.
Now there's some interesting stuff going on. There's an RPG adventure, The Wolf, which is set between some of the pages in issue 5, if I'm reading it right. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. So last year when we did issue number 3 on Kickstarter, we did a role-playing game starter guide. And that was a 20-page floppy comic book, essentially. But it had rules for how to play the characters of Unicorn Vampire Hunter in a Dungeons and Dragons game, and it had some extra lore about the world and some tips for how to run a game, and people really liked that. And so I thought, well, why don't we do a whole adventure that takes place in the world of Unicorn Vampire Hunter? And then I was thinking about it, and I was like, well, if there are people who would be interested in that but don't play Dungeons and Dragons, it would be cool if it was also an additional story set in the world that was an in-canon story, and that you didn't need to know how to play Dungeons and Dragons to read. So it, The Wolf is a story about four of the creatures of the magical marsh on a side adventure that fits neatly into the story of Unicorn Vampire Hunter, but is not essential to read to get the whole story. But it's a side story that I think is really interesting. And you can either play it as a Dungeons and Dragons game or just enjoy it as a little side chapter.
Cool. Now, people get mad at me if I don't do this right away. This project will only be funded if it reaches its goal by Thursday, August 11 at 9:24 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And as we're talking, you've already met your $15,000 goal, so congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, this was maybe the fastest I've ever had a project funded, and certainly we've already beat every funding amount that I've ever had on a Kickstarter. So that's really exciting.
And not only that, you've got more than 300 backers. Wow.
Right. Yep. It's a lot of people are coming out to support, which feels really great. It's a big validation of what I've been building toward and what I've been working on.
What's the biggest number of backers you've had before this?
I believe that my previous issue 2 and 3 had around 550, maybe a little more than that.
Wow.
Around that. So I'm hoping that we can beat that this time. As we're recording, we still have 23 days to go. So maybe if people are listening to this, they might be looking at it and think, well, of course you beat it. But hopefully, we'll see. People from the future can let me know.
Maybe, dude, because you have a vampire detective in space, maybe somebody, one of those future people, can come back and tell you what you did it. Okay, that'll be good. So now, there's something interesting that you and I have not talked about before, and that has to do with this Epic Cross promo.
Oh, yes.
Let me read a little bit about it. It says, until July 28, we're running a cross promo with Pocus Hocus, a phenomenal fantasy series about a magician and his pet rabbit. Of course, I'm always interested in rabbit stuff. If you back our project and Hocus Pocus at any physical level, so that's going on at the same time, then.
So Pocus Hocus is a series by some friends of mine. And it's an awesome project. It's one of my favorite fantasy comics out right now. It's a Faustian tale about a magician who makes a deal with a demon. And then there's this feisty rabbit that's a major character in the book. And Alan, who's one of the writers on that book, reached out to me and wanted to do a cross promo. And so he had Brian Belondo, who is the artist on that series, do this really fun print of Pocus the wizard and his rabbit Horace, along with Edward the unicorn from my series, and they're facing off against vampires. And I think the print's awesome. So people who back both will get that print. I think that by the time we're airing this episode, the Pocus Hocus will be, that campaign will be wrapped, but you should definitely check it out if you haven't seen it or heard about it. They are actually going to be published through Source Point Press, Pocus Hocus is. So we were doing this crossover and we were kind of joking about how we got to be careful because he's being published through Source Point Press and Unicorn Vampire Hunter is being published through Scout. And, you know, we might start a turf war there doing crossovers.
Well, it's kind of funny because the book that I'm editor of, Stabbity Bunny, had a crossover with another book early in an early campaign, and it seemed to go, it went really well for both books. The other book isn't still going, but of course, Stabbity Bunny is still going, so all kinds of good stuff. Just a quick side, probably when this comes and wraps up, The Kickstarter for Stabity Bunny will be done too, so all the bunnies will be home by the time this posts. So that'll be fun. So that's good. So how did you meet this guy with the other book?
Oh, yeah. So Dave Lentz is the letterer on both my book and Alan's book, Hocus Hocus. So like so many things, I'm connected through Dave. Dave Lentz is kind of omnipresent in the indie comic world at this point. He's doing... he's lettering all of my books. He letters Bad Bug books for Mike Tiener. He's doing Pocus Hocus. He also does a lot of Garrett Gunn's books through Source Point Press. So that's like Good Boy and We Eat Gods and a bunch of other books that he does over there. And that's really only scratching the surface of all the stuff that Dave Lentz is doing. And so he likes to connect me with other people that he works with, which I really appreciate because that creates opportunities for really cool new collaborations.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. It's like when you go to conventions. I always ask people, if you're going to go to conventions, make contacts. People at the booth next to you or across the way or something. You know, hook up with them and talk with them and stuff like that and just say hi and maybe get to know them, because you just never know. That might even be more beneficial than the money you make from the table you have. So I always like to point that out.
Oh, for sure. No, 100%. I think I've some of the friends that I've made at conventions are whether I ended up going on to work with them or I just became friends with them and got some great advice or whatever. I mean, Those connections are really important in the indie comic world is really so small, and, you know, making friends and is great because, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. That's what they say, right?
Right, right. That's so true. But speaking of which, Jonathan Fisher has the latest in a series of Unicorn Vampire Hunter stickers, a 3-inch die-cut vinyl sticker that says, "I came to chew gum and kill vampires, and I'm all out of gum."
That's right. I love this sticker. I have loved every sticker that Jonathan has done ever since, the first Unicorn Vampire Hunter. He has done a sticker for me for every single campaign that I've done. So that included Vampire Detective in Space and Modern Mythology, and so he's done a whole bunch of stickers, and they're always a huge hit. Whenever I go to conventions, all of Jonathan's stickers just sell like hotcakes, and they're always tied into whatever book I'm doing at the time. So this one's got Edward the Unicorn, he's chewing bubble gum, which is pretty great. It's hard to say which one of his stickers that he's done for me has been my favorite, but I think this is definitely in contention for that top spot.
Are you out of the previous ones? This is the only one that you've got right now? You've pretty much...
Oh, no, I keep all of Jonathan's stickers in stock. You can't get them on the Kickstarter, but on the backer kit after the Kickstarter, you'll be able to get any of those stickers.
Is that like an add-on?
Yeah, that's like an add-on. So I can, if you back the campaign and you're interested in any of the previous stickers, you'll be able to definitely get them on the backer kit. I just try not to put too many different add-ons on the actual Kickstarter because I don't want it to be overwhelming. But definitely all those will be available. And I keep them all in stock mainly because, like I said, at conventions, they're huge sellers. It's always worth it for me to keep all of his stickers in stock.
Cool, because they do look cool. I really like them. Below the stickers is the latest trading cards in the series. Is it Daryl Toh, T-O-H?
Yep, Daryl Toh, who is the series artist on Unicorn Vampire Hunter, has always done the art for the trading cards. And the trading cards are funny because I have tried to not do the trading cards, but when I ask my audience about it, they say, "Well, no, keep the trading cards. We like the trading cards." So I keep doing them, and I've done trading cards for every iteration of Unicorn Vampire Hunter, and I think this will be the 11th and 12th trading card of the series. So we've done pretty much all of the main characters, and we've started to get into some of the side characters for trading cards. And we are also going to have a, if we hit, I believe it's our $25,000 stretch goal. I'll have to check. But one of our stretch goals coming up is a variant trading card that's actually going to be drawn by Dave Swartz, who is the artist on Vampire Detective in Space. So we may have a 13th trading card that all the backers will get if we hit, $25,000.
Wow. Great, great. I noticed another thing you've got on there, and I'll talk a little bit about the comic in a couple minutes here, but the collector's box, magnetically sealing box that will fit all of your Unicorn Vampire Hunter comics. Art is by Jeremy Treese, and the original painting used in the box art will also be available as an add-on. And you've got an image from Curtis Clow's Beastlands.
Yeah, so this is something was an idea I 100% stole from Curtis Clow, and he and I talk all the time, and he did this collector's box that was really popular. And so what I did a few months ago was I went to my mailing list, to my all my previous backers, and I sent out a survey, and I said, well, what kind of rewards would you guys like to see? You know, I want to try some different stuff. And one of the options that I had a whole bunch of stuff, maybe like 10 or 12 different ideas, kind of like throw in stuff at the wall to see what would stick. And the most popular one by far was this collector's box. A lot of people wanted it. And it turned out, I mean, so far, a lot of people have ordered it. So, you know, they weren't just talking up a big game, because people really did want it. And so I'm glad that I went to the audience and asked them. I mean, I think that's what, you know, we talk about all the time, is like, just ask your fans what they want. And so I did, and this is what they wanted. And this painting by Jeremy Treese is just phenomenal. That'll be on the collector's box. And the painting is for sale, except it sold in the first 10 minutes when we launched the campaign.
Oh, goodness.
So I should probably edit that, because unfortunately you cannot get it. Somebody already claimed it, which is awesome. The collector's box is going to be awesome. It'll hold, I think based on the dimensions that I'm doing, it'll hold like 8 to 10 bagged and boarded comics. But if you have all 5 issues plus the RPG books, that's 7 issues. So it won't hold like all the variants too, but it will hold the complete series. So, and it will look great on a shelf. I think it'll be a good display piece. So I'm super excited about it.
Now, in order to get that, you have to pledge $190 or more.
Yes, it is a little bit of a pricey item. It is also available as an add-on. So if you already have the previous issues, or you don't want all the extras and you just want the collector's box, it is available as an add-on.
How much is it?
It's $75, which sounds like a lot of money, and you're not wrong. It is a lot of money. Unfortunately, they're just really expensive to make. And what I talked to Curtis about it. I'm using the same production company that he used, and they're just really high quality. They're really nice. You know, there were other options where I could have done a cardboard box that would have been way cheaper. But I didn't want to do that. You know, I wanted to offer that premium thing so that people who wanted that really nice item could get it.
And they can't mass produce them, so the price is a little more than if you, let's say you, if you could make a couple hundred thousand of them or something like that, the price would be a lot less.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, but we're talking, I might make 100 of these.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Make some extras so you can take them to the convention.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, I'll within the limits of what I'm able to do, I will order some extras, especially, you know, so that I can, you know, take them to the convention and I can offer them on the next Kickstarter if we have extras. So.
Okay, let's see. I'm trying to go through the ones that are no longer available because those are always interesting. Let's see. All gone. The early bird number 4 and 5 standard physical. Of course, that was because it was early bird, I bet.
Pretty much everything that's gone is the early birds. And this was the first time I ever offered early birds. I had never done it before. And it worked out really well. People were really excited about it. And, you know, you got to save a few bucks if you did the early bird. And I was glad that I did it. I think I may have offered too many different early bird levels. Not that I didn't want to give people a discount. I just think I might have had too many different levels. Like it might have been a little bit confusing. In general, I think next time I'm going to offer fewer total levels. And just rely more on the add-ons for people to customize what they want.
Okay, that's interesting because usually I hear people saying, oh, throw all the add-ons you can in there because you never know what's going to stick with people.
Right, right. Well, I think that I'm tuned in pretty well to kind of what my audience wants. And I always tell people that if there's something that I'm not offering that you'd like to see me offer, if it's within my power to do, I can edit the Kickstarter while it's going and add new add-ons. I'm more than happy to do that for people. And then when it gets to the other part of it is that when it gets to the backer kit, I offer everything. I mean, you can buy the kitchen sink on the backer kit. So in the backer kit, the storefront is more robust. You actually can see images of the add-ons and everything. And so I think that that is helpful for people because then, you know, if there's extra stuff that they wanted, they can kind of really get a good visual on it.
Maybe someday you actually will offer a kitchen sink, though. Now, you've mentioned this list a couple times. Is there any way to get on this list that you seek their opinion of, or is that something you kind of keep private?
Oh, no. If you back a Kickstarter, you can... any of my Kickstarters, it's one of the survey questions if you want to be added to the list. I also have a link on my website to go, which is CalebPalmquist.com, but to join the mailing list. And then also on the Kickstarter page, near the top, I have a link to get the first issue for free. And if you by clicking that link and signing, like you have to sign up for the mailing list to get the free issue. So I definitely don't keep it a secret. Anyone who wants to join the mailing list can join it. And if you're not sure how to join it, you can just contact me through the Kickstarter or, you know, on social media. And I will definitely add you to it. I'm more than happy to, because I love people being on that mailing list. I send out a good amount of emails. I know when people start email lists, they're always like, don't worry, I won't send you a bunch of emails. Well, what I'll tell you is I will send you an email every single week. And the reason for that is because I always have new stuff to share. The emails that I send are not here, buy this thing, go give me money. The emails are, I just got new art from my artist and I want you to see it. Or I'm trying to decide between these two covers, like which sketch should we use for the cover? I want you to vote on it. And things like that. And so you get to be part of the process and you get to see new art before anyone else does. So I definitely don't keep it a secret. It's something I really enjoy doing and, you know, always happy to see.
I got to ask though, has the group ever voted something and you said, nope, that's not how I want to do it. I want to do something, something else. Has that ever happened to you?
That's a good question. So the group doesn't always vote in the way that I would have chosen, but I always kind of, I never give options where I feel like I definitely wouldn't want to do this, you know? So like there were, when Jeremy Trace drew the cover for, or painted the cover for the collector's box, he did 4 sketches. And he sent, and I sent out the four sketches. There were four different compositions to the group, and I had my favorite. And the one that everyone picked was not the one that was my favorite. But I liked all of them, and it turned out so amazing that, you know, I think it was, I think it would have been foolish, for me to, you know, go against what the group wanted, because they were telling me, here's what we want. And, you know, and I think it's better for it. Now I'm not crowdsourcing like story decisions on there, you know, I'm like telling the story the way I want to tell it. But I certainly sometimes get feedback from people where they say, hey, look, you haven't been offering this and that sucks. Or you did this thing that this way and I didn't like that. And I really value that because, you know, I don't always, I'm making it all up as I go along. So, you know.
It's funny because so many times you think it's the right way to go and your fans will, and you know, it might be for you, but you want to kind of get the, what the fans want, because like you're saying, if you offer, you know, options and people actually look at them and tell you what they want, sometimes the, you know, not always, but the fans often are just steering you in the right direction.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, 100%. I mean, and what I love about the fans on this book is it's obvious that they've read the book and that they love the book and they care about the characters and they want to, and they're invested in it. You know, and that's what I'm doing it for, you know, is, I'm telling a story that hopefully people like, and it seems like they do from the feedback that I get. And so, you know, and we have such a unique opportunity with Kickstarter and with just kind of the internet in general, this, you know, direct to consumer marketing and publishing, we have such a unique opportunity to connect with fans, and to connect with the people that are reading our work. And why wouldn't we take advantage of that? You know,
It's so different from like DC or Marvel, where they have basically no idea what, right, what fans, all they can do is hope that they're getting it right. And sometimes they don't, you know, people say, why did you do such a crazy thing? And all they can say is, well, we thought it was a good idea at the time. But see, this is one of the things that are so good about crowdfunding is you have direct contact with the people who spend the money on your book, and that can make a difference.
100%. Yep.
Yeah, so that's really great. So we'll get the story here. 1 second here. I'm always interested when people put the budget, and you list how the budget is divided up. 60% is for art, lettering, and design. The next biggest one is printing, shipping, and packaging. Mm-hmm. Then you get to miscellaneous expenses. Then there's Kickstarter fees, which, of course, everyone has. Payment processing fees to it. People don't realize that many times that there are, in order to process the funds, everybody has to take their share. And so that's what they do with that. So I'd like to see when people tell you exactly what your money's going to. And I think that was a wise idea.
Yeah, I always do this. And, you know, these are estimates, but obviously the art and everything is the most expensive part. You know, between Daryl, who draws the comic, and Dave, who letters it, they're putting in, you know, a lot of hours. And so, you know, paying them is the biggest chunk, I think. You know, if it weren't for that, you know, if all that stuff, just if I had a genie and just like magic to the art into existence, I could set goals for Kickstarter a lot lower. But the basic Daryl and Dave, I mean, this is like full time what they do. You know, not just my project, but comics. And so, you know, we definitely got to get them taken care of.
Oh, yeah. This is, some people think that just the exposure is worth all that time and effort. I tend to think not. Mm-hmm. Tend to think not. Now, why don't we dive into the story? I've been kind of holding off on it because we've talked about the story before. But as you're coming to the end of the first arc, I've got some questions about how you're going to handle it.
Sure.
But let's start off by doing a little bit of recapping so people know who we're talking about. The young woman. Who's the curious young woman?
The curious young woman is a girl named Jezebel. She is a woman who as a girl, as a teenager, came to live with her uncle Seamus, who is a wizard. He lives in a place called the Magical Marsh. And then she kind of finished growing up there. And she came to the Magical Marsh because she lived in this dangerous city with her parents, and her parents were worried for her safety. So they sent her to live with her uncle. Well, little did they know, there's a vampire infestation in the Dark Forest, which borders the Magical Marsh. Soon enough, Jezebel gets herself in trouble with vampires, but she is saved by a unicorn named Edward, who is really the titular character of the book. But I would say that those three characters, Edward, Seamus, and Jezebel, really are the main characters equally. They get into some trouble with vampires, and without heavy spoilers, they end up getting into a little more trouble than they can handle. And by the end of issue 3, Edward the Unicorn is going off on his own mission to kind of discover some secrets of his past, while Seamus and Jezebel are in some deep trouble that they may or may not be able to get out of. And that's where we left off with issue 3. So issue 4 is going to see Edward off on his own journey, and we're going to learn a lot about Edward's past. And I think issue 4 is the darkest issue that I have written for this series. It's very emotional. Mm. It has to deal with family and trying to be enough for your parents and struggling with disappointment. It's very heavy, very personal topics, all wrapped up in a fantasy frame. But then issue 5 is where everything comes to a head. Issue like any final issue of an arc, there's a big confrontation, several big confrontations, and all the character arcs that we're building get conclusions.
Okay, now, without spoiling anything, how do you feel about arcs that end on a cliffhanger?
So that depends. It depends on whether or not the emotional core of the arc was satisfied.
So
what I'll tell you is, at the end of this arc, there is sort of like almost like a post-credits stinger, sort of. I mean, like the way that the arc ends, it's very obvious that there will be another arc. And because of the success we've had, we are 100% planning on doing a second arc. But I think that the story that we were telling has been wrapped up by this arc. The emotional story, the characters, where they were going, has been wrapped up while also leading into new things. So I like cliffhangers as long as they serve the story and they're not just like, oh, well, we didn't act. This isn't the end. And we haven't finished the story. And we just are, keeping you hooked.
Because you see, cliffhangers sometimes drive me crazy, especially if there's a delay, say, between arcs.
Well, you may or may not be upset with me then. there's definitely a cliffhanger at the end of this one, but hopefully it will feel satisfying. Hopefully you'll be glad you read it. I originally had two endings because I wasn't sure how well this whole book was going to be received, but I knew exactly the story and the 5 issues that I wanted to tell. And so there was an alternate ending where everything was truly wrapped up, where it would be like, okay, this is a one and done trade paperback. That's the whole story. There will never be more. But I was only going to do that if I felt like the audience wasn't going to be on board with a whole nother arc. And given the success that we've had and the enthusiasm that I've gotten, you know, I think people will be on for another arc, will be on for more story. And I think they want more story. So that's what I'm going to give them.
Okay, so because we liked it so much and supported it so much, we're not going to get a wrap up.
Yeah, I suppose.
Okay, well, that's okay, because the more story is better than a shorter story, as long as you're telling a good story, and that's why I'm sure. Because every time I think about Edward, there's a big reveal in those early issues about Edward that kind of surprised me. And that's one of the things I like about your writing, is you do those kinds of surprises really well and keep us going, what? I got to read more. How'd that happen? Kind of stuff. I like that.
Well, I mean, I like the idea of, you know, this is a comic about a unicorn that hunts vampires. And you think, oh, wow, that's a twist that I didn't see coming, like right off the bat. But then I'm like, well, but it's more than that. Then here's a whole other twist in issue number two. And you know, I just like continuing to do unexpected things. And the second arc of the story, I think, is going to go in a direction that I don't think anyone will have predicted. I think people might even think I'm a little crazy for where I'm about to take the story. You know, I have always thought that I need to be true to the story that I want to tell. And to do the crazy ideas that I have. So hopefully it'll work out. You know, if not, you know, maybe I'll have everyone saying, oh, you screwed it up. It was so good right up until issue six and you ruined it. But, you know, we'll see.
Well, what you might do is go back and reprint the issue number five and put the ultimate ending. Right. That way it'll be done. One of the things I really enjoy about what you're doing with unicorns is usually unicorns are rainbows and happy and pixie dust and all kinds of happy things. Your unicorn is not that. I mean, right away, the moment he uses his horn to basically kill vampires, that's not the unicorns I'm used to. And so right away, I'm interested because the other ones are very predictable. Your unicorn is not predictable, which is something I love in the story. Please don't go the same path that I've already gone 100 times. And you don't do that, which is something I think is really great. It's one of the reasons I think this book has taken off, because it's not same old story stuff, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, the unicorn is, he's a grumpy, emotional boy with a tragic past, and he's very grumpy about a lot of stuff, and he's not afraid to let you know it. And he's also, you know, in the story, he's meant to be the greatest warrior who ever lived. And so, you know, how is he going to do that if he doesn't have, you know, awesome fight scenes. So.
Mm-hmm. Good. Now, when will these issues be released?
So issue four is already done. It's 100% ready to go to print. And so after the Kickstarter ends, I'm actually going to send issue four out digitally to the backers. And then Daryl is drawing issue five right now. And I believe that I have the estimated delivery as December, and I'm very confident that we'll hit that. I think that there's a very good chance that we'll get it done well before then.
Okay.
But I always like to put, you know, a pretty long deadline just in case there are delays.
It's like Scotty. That's how you maintain your reputation as a miracle worker.
Right. So hopefully, you know, before December, we'll be getting them printed and getting them sent out. It's on some of my previous campaigns, I had everything 100% ready to go, before I launched the campaign. And then, you know, I could print them and get them shipped out like lightning fast. And, I'm doing a little bit of a different approach this time. It's sort of a middle ground. It's, you won't have to wait like, you know, months and months or years for the comic, but you also, you're not going to get it immediately. Well, you're going to get digital four, number four immediately, but, the other stuff you might have to wait a little longer for. You know, I think it's just a iteration, experimenting with what I'm doing. I think people were excited for this comic. And so I wanted to, you know, give them the opportunity to get involved and pre-order it. So hopefully that'll work out.
Of course, December is a great time to release stuff. It's like gift giving for people to support. So that's going to work out real well. What about the Wolf one shot?
That one is the main thing about that. It will be released at the same, like physically, it'll be released at the same time as issue 4 and 5. I don't necessarily want to promise when I'm going to send out the digital because we're still playtesting it. We've done a few playtests, but it is a game, right? It's a Dungeons and Dragons game. And so I want to make sure to get it right. And I think that's such an important process. The first time we playtested it, I was like, oh man, there were these like big, massive changes that I needed to make. And I was so glad that I put together a playtesting team and we actually sat down and played it as a Dungeons and Dragons game because there were some really glaring flaws that I didn't realize. And so we've been able to make some adjustments. So for sure, it will be released at the same time that issue 5 is released, possibly sooner. It kind of depends on, you know, how I do with, you know, those playtests and whether or not my playtesting group thinks it's ready.
Okay, well, obviously it looks like you're going to be successful with this thing. What's the next project you're going to be working on? Do you have another Kickstarter this year, or how are you going to go forward with that?
If I am able to, I want to do Vampire Detective in Space and wrap up that storyline. Just like this one, where I had the final two issues. My current plan is to do the final two. Vampire Detective in Space is only 4 issues long, and I'd like to do the final 2 issues of that in one go, as well. You know, like everything, you know, schedules can change, and it depends on if everything goes, you know, smoothly and according to plan, and there aren't any major delays. That's my plan. So the next thing would be Vampire Detective in Space. And then I have a few other things planned that are kind of in early stages, but I would say that it's safe to assume that at some point I'll be doing a Vampire or Unicorn Vampire Hunter trade paperback that would be like a sort of Kickstarter exclusive limited version that will be different than Scout's version. I'm just not sure exactly when I'll be doing that. And then of course, at some point I'll be doing issues of the next arc of Unicorn Vampire Hunter.
Cool.
So, you know, with Kickstarter, my temptation is always to run as many as I possibly can. But I come up against limitations, right. Like my own sanity.
Okay, so it's good to think about, you know, do it the best that works for you so we get the best quality stuff rather than rushing and doing sort of less than best kind of thing. So I think that's right. The best way to do. Well, that's cool. So but you got all kinds of good things going on, Caleb, and as always, it's great fun to read these good things. I'm just going to be fascinated to see how you're going to wrap this up, particularly knowing that you've got more future for this series. It's going to be fun to read.
Thanks.
Now, if people want to keep up with you, well, before I get to that, are you going to be doing any conventions this year? What's your plan for that?
Yes, I am. I am going to be doing, at the end of August, so coming up really soon, is Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle, Washington.
Ooh, good con.
Yep, I'm very excited for that one. That'll be my first time tabling at that convention. And then in September, early September, I'm doing Rose City Comic Con in Portland, Oregon. So those are both pretty exciting. They're pretty good cons. You know, I've been to Emerald City as a fan, and I've tabled at Rose City, and I enjoy those a lot. So if you're in Western Washington or, you know, Western Oregon, and you're planning on going to either of those conventions, then I may see you there. So yeah,
great.
One of those.
Great, great. Now, as I was starting to ask, as far as like social media goes, how do people follow you on social media?
You can follow me at Caleb Palmquist on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also find me at Unicorn Vampire Hunter on Instagram and Facebook. Those would definitely be the best ways. You can also go to unicornvampirehunter.com. I always redirect that URL to whatever the most relevant current thing is to do with the comic book. And if you want to go to my website or the Kickstarter and get on that mailing list, to be honest, that is the number one best way to keep up to date with what I'm doing. Because I'm very bad at social media, but I take a lot of pride in my mailing list. And I'm always updating them with the latest stuff.
I know that I've asked this of you before because it pops right into my head every time we talk. Are you ever going to, have you considered crossing over Vampire Hunter with Unicorn Vampire Hunter with your vampire detective?
I have considered it. It's possible. It's possible I'll do something silly and small, like an ash can or something that crosses them over. But right now I don't have any plans. They are very different stories. They both have vampires in them, but it is they are very, very different stories. So it's nothing's impossible. No plans right now.
Okay, because I love a good crossover, so that's why pretty much everybody I ask who's got more than one story, I ask if they're going to cross over at some point, because I think that's always fun. But if, you know, when the time comes, that'll be great. But until then, we'll just enjoy the stories as they're happening. So, Caleb, is always wonderful stuff. Can't wait to see this stuff. And then once that's done, we'll be patiently but still excitedly waiting for the second arc. Do you have any idea what you're going to call it?
Do I have any idea what I'm going to call the arc?
Yeah, the second arc.
Oh. Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't actually know. I think Scout's going to want me to come up with a name for the first trade paperback. I don't even know what I'm going to call the first arc, to be honest. I think in my head, the first arc is called Jezebel and the Unicorn, but just because that was the original title of the comic book before I changed it to Unicorn Vampire Hunter, which I think was probably a pretty smart change. I have some ideas about what I'll call the second arc, but I don't actually want to tell you because it would spoil what happens.
Okay, so stay tuned, in other words. Okay, well, it's looking great. I can't wait to see it. It's going to be fun. Again, it's Unicorn Vampire Hunter, and the complete name of the Kickstarter is Unicorn Vampire Hunter 1-5. So be sure to get the Kickstarter and look that up. And once again, because people get mad at me when I don't do this enough, project will be funded if you've already reached your goal. If it reaches its goal by Thursday, August 11th at 9:24 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So hopefully you've hit your 500 backers by the time that this posts. And if not, then we need more backers. So you need to get out there and support this. But keep it up, Caleb. You're doing wonderful stuff.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.